My name is Tyler Humphreys. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety is January 13, 2003, and I am, you guys might not be impressed, but I'm very impressed with that. I think for a guy like myself, it's just proof. The proof is in the pudding. And for myself, I've been in and out of the program. I've tried, intensive outpatient programs, inpatient programs, detoxes, all the different anonymous programs that I could find. I've been trying to get sober since I was 16, and finally this time around I got sober at 23, and it's just been crazy, and I can tell you this, I only have a short amount of time, but I'll just tell you straight out, this is the first time that I got a sponsor, went through all 12 steps in a row with that sponsor, and went on to sponsor other people. The very first time, and for me, like I said, that's the proof. The proof is in the pudding, and this time I actually tasted the pudding. I come from a single mother household. I was never beaten, raped, locked in closets. I had a decent childhood. If your childhood was any different than mine, man, my heart goes out to you. I never felt a lack of love, nothing. My mom was a hustler. She went to school full time, worked full time. She was a PTA mom, a soccer mom, a Girl Scout, a boy. She did it all for us. And in fact, a lot of the stuff that we learned around here in Alcoholics Anonymous, my mom was teaching us at a very young age. Thanksgiving is like, before we can eat our meal, we have to go take pies down to the homeless shelter. Like Christmas, we'd unwrap all of our presents except for one, and we'd take those to the homeless shelter. This was the stuff that my mom was trying to do with us. So if sobriety had anything to do with morals or ethics or any of that kind of stuff, I would have got sober a long time ago, and I probably wouldn't have been in this mess. So what happened? And what I found along the way is that I found out that I'm an alcoholic. And what does that mean to me? What does it mean to be an alcoholic? It means when I put that juice in my system, doesn't matter how much juice I put in my system, when I put that juice in my system, it kicks me in my gut, man. It lights my soul on fire. And, we come into AA and we talk about, all this, the stuff that made me dance and made me, be smoother with the chicks and make sex better. We have all these things, but the truth is it does that to normal people. That's not just an alcoholic thing. It doesn't just have this warm, fuzzy effect feeling on just alcoholics. That's what booze is supposed to do. But what happens differently from my mom, is that when I put that juice in my system, my soul gets lit on fire, man, and I will throw anything on the line just for one more taste. And I got to the point in my life, man, to where it was, like you said, I cannot picture life with or without it. I got to this point to where I was looking in the mirror, man, and I was not okay with what I was doing, was not okay with who I became. I knew for a fact that I could not stay sober, but I wanted to learn how to stop hurting people. And those were my options, and that's what brought me into Alcoholics Anonymous. Through a series of events, I ran into a men's big book study, and this guy, just kind of the backup. The night before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I just dropped out of another treatment center. I had 4 days sober, and I found an amazing reason to drink. They were burning this tree, or they were plowing this tree in Burbank. It's a 400-year-old tree. They're plowing this tree, and there's this hippie shackled up in the tree, right? And he's like trying to save the tree. And I'm watching this on the news, and I'm going, I'm getting all passionate, and I'm getting drunk, and I'm calling all my best friends from rehab. I've known them 4 days, but they're like my brothers now. We're real tight. And I'm calling them all, and I'm saying, listen, they're trying to plow the damn tree. We need to get out there. Somebody drive me. I got license issues. I don't have a car. I need to get out and save the damn tree. I'm calling the Channel 9 News. I'm calling, like, hey, a friend of mine said that if the tree gets torn down, that they're going to plant bombs in the freeway. And I'm calling the Burbank Police Department, all this crazy stuff, man. And finally, I got this dude on the phone from my rehab. His name was Kevin, and he said, you know what? He just paused. He says, Tyler, you're effing loaded, man. And I sunk back into my couch, and I'm looking around the room, and one more time, I'm all alone. And after that, the very next day, January 13th, 2003, I went back into that rehab, and I got all my hugs and all my stuff, and I completed that rehab, and I started going to AA. Have you noticed that? Every single treatment center, that's what they do. Okay, you're done. Now go, go to AA, and this is the aftercare. And one more time, I was back at the one place in this world that I hated more than anything. Alcoholics Anonymous. Here we go again. And I was sick of hearing, they would talk to me about their book, and at the time I called it the stupid effing book, and the stupid effing sponsor, and I had these names that I made up for everything that you guys talk about. And my biggest problem was, when it's 2 o'clock in the morning, and that fury's on me, and I need to drink, and I know the only thing that'll take this away is to put that bottle to my lips and just tilt my head back. How are those steps, how is that sponsor, how is that
stupid effing bullet's going to save me then. And, you know, this man confronted me and he said, Tyler, look, you know, and I was obsessed with suicide at the time and, you know, he's threatening me and you know, all this kind of crazy stuff. And he said, you know what, Tyler, have you ever worked a program of Alcoholics Anonymous? And I said, absolutely. I've gone to 9,000 meetings in 900 days. I got a sponsor. I got, you know, I swept up. I served coffee. I was doing the ashtrays. I went half an hour before the meeting, stayed half an hour late. I did all the stuff that you guys tell me. Haven't you seen me for the last couple of years? And the guy, and he stopped me. He said, Tyler, have you ever worked the program of Alcoholics Anonymous? Yeah, didn't you just hear what I just said? He goes, no, have you ever got a sponsor, worked all 12 steps in a row with that sponsor, and went on to sponsor other people? I go, well, I mean, come on, if you're going to be technical about it, no, I guess I haven't tried Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, you know what, I challenge you to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, I know you want to commit suicide, and you know what, that might be okay. However, it sounds like there's at least one more thing in this world that you have not tried yet. And so he challenged me, and that would be, you know, in this quick little 10 minutes, that would be my only message tonight, is if you're like me, or if you're like a lot of us who have been in and out of here, in and out of here, you come in and you see AA's working for him, and, you know, they're happy, and, you know, this guy came out from underneath the bridge, and now he's the president of Bank of America, and you're seeing all this stuff go on, but you're wondering why it's not working for you, I would challenge you to do what our book talks about. And bottom line, man, our book doesn't talk about meetings two times. Talks about meetings two times. It says we meet frequently so that the newcomer can find the fellowship they seek. And it says we, and also so that the newcomer can bring their problems. This is not your recovery. In fact, tonight we're not even doing AA. We're here and we're listening and maybe talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. But the program, the steps, man, are where the statistics are at. If you have not taken the time to get a sponsor and go through those 12 steps and then apply that stuff in your life, and the kicker, gone on to help other people do it, there still might be one more thing out there for you. And thank God this man explained it to me like that. You know, it's been a wild roller coaster. Bottom line, I mean, the highlight of it is, you know, I became a father, and I was about 5 years sober, and I was a father of this two-week-old little baby girl, and mom, she was in AA, you know, that whole story, and she's hugging the toilet and puking all over the place and back on the bottle and driving around drunk with my daughter in her car, and, you know, now what do you do? Now where's your recovery? I mean, what do I do? Do I go to my 9,685 meetings? Do I, you know, have all my commitments? What do I do? How do I stay sober and still be a father to this little girl? And what I did, man, is, you know, people talk to me again, and they said, it's about applying this stuff in your life. AA is not a substitute for your life. AA is to prepare you so you can have a life, Tyler. And what I did is I started sliding my sponsor. When she's taking a nap, I'm sliding sponsors in the backyard, and we're going through the book. And then she'd wake up, I'd feed her, I'd change her diaper, I'd burp her, put her back to bed, and then get another sponsor, man. And so I found a way that our book talks about to apply this stuff in our life, be able to stay sober and be the rock in my daughter's life. You know, I remember this one time, she's just screaming, and she has fevers, and she's, you know, all the stuff, and I'm sitting there screaming out, like, why me? Why is this happening? Please, take this away. I hope, you know, why does my daughter have to hurt? And I understand. And next thing you know, man, like I just got all peaceful, and I was just sitting there thinking, you know what? I can't take away my daughter's pain. I cannot take away her sickness. But Alcoholics Anonymous has transformed me into a man who could be a rock. I could be the shoulder for that daughter to cry on when she is in pain. When I was 23 and I got sober, that's a long stretch, man. So if that's all I get out of this deal, I'm forever grateful. And I'm thankful for Bill for letting me come down here and the other Bill for letting me ride with him. And I'm going to shut up so we can hear his story. Thank you.
Into the Bank of America. The guy that's running it came out from under a bridge. Amazing the stuff you learn in AA, isn't it? This is what happens when you don't say no to AA requests. You end up in Visalia. I'm driving in here this afternoon and it said 98 degrees on my thing. I go, what the hell am I doing in Visalia? Sometimes it's Hawaii. Today it's Visalia. You know, I'm an AA zealot. I bought the whole package. I shaved my head. I got the special underwear. You know, the secret handshake and the nickname and the whole thing. I'm a zealot. I bought the whole package. I believe it all. I've done it all. I have no rational explanation for that. My previous history before getting to AA would not lead you to believe that I would jump into it with both feet and just live it for the rest of my life, but here I am. My sobriety date is March the 27th, 1985. And I have never been bored in AA. In 27 years, I have never been bored. I've been pissed off, and I've been hurt and injured, and I've been treated poorly on many occasions. But I've never been bored. I can tell you, if you're sitting here tonight in this AA meeting and you're bored, it truly is because you are boring. This is better than any reality television show you'll ever see. I mean, you can stay sober around here for a long time on just the stories alone. You know? And I'm sure you have an Alano Club around here. You know, whenever you're bored, just go to the Alano Club and sit back and watch the show. You know, just watch the show. It's incredible. You know, a couple of things happened to me that I feel really lucky about. When I got here, I was like anybody else that gets to Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not want to be here. This is not my choice. I ended up here. But really quickly, within a couple of days, I just liked it. You know? I mean, I can remember driving home after a meeting. It was either the first meeting or second meeting, one of the early meetings I went to. And it was one of these crazy meetings. It was called the Gong Show. It was at the Hermosa Beach Alano Club on Friday night. A lot of people say it really wasn't an AA meeting. It probably wasn't, you know. I mean, it was totally politically incorrect. And everybody was acting crazy. And it was a big Friday night meeting. People were dressed up, and they all had their girls with them. And the other guys are looking for girls. And it was just good. I'm standing in the back of the room trying to be cool. You ever tried to be cool in AA? It's impossible. Matter of fact, my friend Scott Redman used to say that Alcoholics Anonymous has offered me a level of lameness that I did not know was available. You know? I mean, this is a new paradigm of stupid, you know, it's like, you know, but I'm back there like everybody else, trying to be cool, right? And I'm watching this show, and I remember distinctly driving home thinking to myself, this may not be so bad. Because I was laughing. You made me laugh. Like many people talk about, I hadn't really laughed really hard in a long time. And you were funny. And I got the joke. And not everybody does. Not everybody gets the joke. Not everybody gets here and likes it. You know? And I had a guy not long ago call me up on the phone, and I've watched this guy come in and out of AA for, God, 10 or 15 years. Painful to watch. And he calls me up and he goes, you know, Bill, I don't know what to do. And I go, what's the matter? And he goes, I just can't stand the meetings. I just hate them. What should I do? I sat and I thought, and I go, man, I don't know, man. I don't know. I guess you can make yourself go for a while. But I said, answer me this. How come you don't like them? What is it about it that is so painful to you? And he couldn't really give me a clear answer, you know. But you know what it is now that I think about it, if some time has gone by, is he can't hear the music. All he hears is the words. And like, I don't know about you, but what I get in touch with, especially in my home group on Monday night, is that I'm sitting in a room full of people whose lives have been saved. there's a lot of energy around that. You know, there's people that literally have been born again. I mean, the rest of the world is trying to get born again. We're just sitting around here trying to figure out what the hell happened. You know? Isn't that true? I was sitting with a really pretty high-powered AA guru some years ago. I mean, not an AA guru, but an Indian guru, a guy from India. And I was going and listening to him, and after he gave a talk to a bunch of people, there was two or three of us that were sitting around with him in this back room, just sitting and talking, and he looks at me, and he starts laughing, and I said, "What are you laughing at?" And he goes, "I just love you alcoholics and drug addicts." And I said, "Why is that?" He goes, "Well, the rest of them out there are trying to get awakened. You're just trying to figure out what the hell happened." You know? And he was sincere about that. I think that's true about us. We have been awakened. And we're just lame enough that we don't pick up on that, you know. We're just going to another meeting, you know. The second thing that happened to me that I think I was very lucky, just pure luck, is I asked a man to help me, and he invited me right into his home. I was outside of a meeting, and I asked him, I said, "You know, I need to get a sponsor. It's been a couple of weeks. I've been banging around meetings." And I asked him for help, and he says, "You know, read the doctor's opinion and make notes in the margin of what you agree with and what you don't. Be at my house Thursday at 5 o'clock. And we'll go over it and we'll discuss it." Now, I thought you were all doing this. I thought this is what every... How would I know any different? I didn't know. I didn't know that there were people you could go up and ask them and they'd say, "Well, yeah, sure, read the book. If you run into a problem, give me a call." You know, I didn't know that there was that kind of sponsorship or the kind that you hear about a lot, "My sponsor is my best friend. We're really friends, you know. I've got the same sponsor for 27 years. He's still my enemy. You know, he's the sponsor. I have friends that I can talk to about my sponsor. What did your sponsor tell you? You know, I mean, what Jay, my sponsor, says, you know, the first thing he does with new guys, and he actually did this with me, is introduce me to other guys that are getting sober around the same time so that you have a group of people that you can get together with and talk about how horrible it is you're being treated by your sponsor, you know, because it helps. It cushions the blow. And I showed up to his house Thursday at 5 o'clock, and he did not trust me that I'd read it, and he had me sit there and read it to him out loud. Rule number one when you're working with people, make sure they read the book. Don't trust them. Read it with them. Make sure they read it. And we went through the book, and he would bring things to my attention, and I would ask him my questions or my comments and what I agreed with and what I didn't like, and we started the process, and he worked the steps with me alone in a room, just the two of us. I got lucky. I found a guy that was willing to do that. He wasn't intimidated by me. He wasn't impressed by me. He wasn't afraid of me. I don't mean that physically, but there's just a lot of people that are really unwilling to sit alone with somebody else. It's too intimate. It's too scary. It's inconvenient as hell. And it continues to be inconvenient in my life. And I love it. And as Tyler said, that's Alcoholics Anonymous to me. My email is BillC@KitchenTableAA.com. Sitting across the kitchen table. That's where AA really happens. The meetings just reflect what's going on in the local community of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I love it. But I was a surfer and a biker and a tough guy. And I never went to the beach. My motorcycle rarely ran. And I was afraid to fight. But I looked really good. I had a chrome Nazi helmet for a hat and a primary chain for a belt and black greasy Levi's and big black boots with chains around them. I've got tattoos all over me, but I had a clip-on earring because I didn't want to hurt myself. My biker nickname was Horny. I have it tattooed on my arm right here. And it's misspelled. It's H-O-R-N-E-Y. Horny. That's pretty much all you need to know about me. And I mean, at 17, I was a bad drunk in high school. Every one of us tells the same story. We all tell the same story. I mean, the events of the story can be different in the area, the culture, what we do and don't do. Some of us are outgoing. Some of us are introverted. Some of us are out in the street all the time. Others of us are hiding in the bathroom for 20 years or so. You know, some of us have virtually no social skills at all when we get here, you know. And but we all tell the same story in that we talk about long before we ever drank, we didn't feel part of. We all say that. We all talk about feeling disconnected, not part of. And, you know, the aliens had dropped us off and we're waiting for the mothership to return, you know. We have a cute way of describing it. But everyone tells that story. And we talk about that experience like it's unique, like it only happens to us. The reason all of us tell that story is because every kid feels like that. Every kid feels like that. The difference between us and them is that we medicated that feeling and we never grew out of it. And when we get to Alcoholics Anonymous, we are the same kid. I was 37 years old when I got here, and on a good day I had the emotional development of a 16-year-old, and that kid was not an honor student. He was the one with a bit of a problem with authority. That kid. Remember that kid? The lad with the big jacket and the slouch and the sneer and the foul mouth and the bad attitude. That kid. I was 17. I'm walking around carrying a gun. At 17, I'd already been to jail. At 17. Started drinking seriously at 15. You know, before that, you'd chip away at it. But, you know, within a couple of years, I was this monster. You know, I mean, the truth is, I wasn't very nice even before then. But we all tell that story. And usually when we tell the story about being disconnected, we'll say stuff like, I had the ism long before I drank. We say things like, I had alcoholic thinking. As if there is such a thing. I mean, you can repeat stuff around here and people will just start repeating it like it's real. Like, well, alcoholic, well, I've got alcoholic thinking. Hey, that's my problem, alcoholic thinking. You know? The only place you ever hear that term, alcoholic thinking, is in Alcoholics Anonymous. No one else ever uses that term. You know what the professional community says about us? They say that we are emotionally immature. And we hear that and we go, no! I have special thinking. I have alcoholic thinking, and it's never going away. And you need to consider that when you're dealing with me. I have special thinking. And I'm convinced, I think we're just emotionally immature. And now that we're sober, we're going to grow up now. And we're a little late. And the chances of us doing that and looking good are really slim. It's not going to be cute. I'm the guy that walks into the room, and if you're looking at me, it's what the hell are you looking at? And if you don't look at me, I'm heartbroken. And there is nothing in between. There's not like striations of emotional development, you know. I mean, the depth of my shallowness knows no bounds. And the psychotherapeutic community is trying to get me to dig up that and uncover that good little Billy that got suppressed a long time ago, you know? And I'm convinced he ain't there. But it's not there. It never developed. It never got developed. Most of us, not all of us, but most of us started drinking in puberty. You know, some people at 10, 11. A lot of us at 12, 13. Most of us 14, 15, 16. Right when we're growing up. Right in the middle of it all. You know, And part of the story we tell is we feel this disaffect, this disconnect from society, from our family, and then we have a couple of pops and it all goes away. Tyler was describing it, you know. I think the whole idea of behind the drinking thing, if I remember correctly, is to have a couple of pops and get out of the house and go to the party and have some fun and meet her or him and have an adventure. And alcohol is the social lubricant. I ended up naked in my living room watching religious television taking notes. Party! You know? And I'm having sex, menage a uno. There's no one else in the room. You know? I mean, we're partying with Billy now. It's getting serious. You know? The next time you see some guy come walking in and he says, I'm just a party kind of guy, ask him, how many other people were at the party? Not far from here is Bass Lake. 4th of July, 1966. Hell's Angels rode into that valley, and I found my career path. And I thought, yeah, I want to be a gunslinger, you know, bad guy. Wear a big long duster and get me a Harley, carry guns, and be tough, you know. It still looks good to me today. See some old fat bastard with a gray beard on his head, cast iron Harley going at night, I look at him, I go, go get him, dude. Never say die. You know? I'm driving my Chrysler, you know. We just love the dark side, don't we? It never goes away, either. I'm always looking over there on that side of the railroad tracks, just kind of keeping an eye on it. You never know. Kind of fun over there. That weekend I met her. And she lived in Oregon and was supposed to take the bus back, and then I drove her back myself. We went up there to grow our home. And it was the 60s. You'll hear Pete tonight. It was a great time to be getting high. It was just incredible. Absolutely incredible. Every decade since has wanted to be us, you know? I mean, the road from L.A. to San Francisco was the road to Nirvana, and Golden Gate Park was the center of the universe. They weren't eating hitchhikers yet, so it was safe to travel. The young ladies were discovering their sexuality, and we were helping them as best we could. You'll hear people say, I wouldn't trade my worst day sober for my best day drunk. I wouldn't trade 66 and 67 for anything. From what I understand, it was a real hoot. We got married, had a couple of kids, and by the time I was 22, I was in the Oregon State Mental Institution. And I was running with an outlaw motorcycle gang, and I was sticking needles in my arm every day and drinking like a fish and not coming home to that family, and they were on welfare. We lost a house and a couple of cars and jobs, and it was horrible. It was horrible. Short party. Short party. Some of us were able to drink successfully for a while. That was never my story. You know, as soon as I picked it up, as soon as I started doing it, I just went in the toilet immediately. My life just stopped, and it got worse and worse and worse. Anybody else been in a mental institution? Oh, come on. There's a bunch of you out there going, Hannah Healy wasn't an institution. They were just observing me. Well, you can count AA as kind of an institution, you know. The state of Oregon thought I should leave. I agreed. And I came back down to Los Angeles and tried to get normal. And what normal is, for a lot of us, if you got to quit shooting heroin, you can't get anybody to go along with the concept of social heroin use. It's pretty much a lifestyle. So I just quit. You know, I just quit. You got to quit taking acid because normal people have two-way communication with each other. And with LSD, you don't need the other person. You know, you can, it's pretty much a one-sided kind of a thing, you know. And you can party with yourself. You can only drink on the weekends because normal people have jobs. They go to them days in a row. I've seen them do it. I've watched them. It's incredible, you know. And when I drink, I don't show up no matter what. Everything literally stops. I can't make it to work. I'm busy. So you can only drink on the weekends. What you do during the week is you smoke pot because it's green and it's from God and it's not really drugs. Because I don't know about you, but the impact of your personality on me is devastating. I cannot do you. I need something in me all the time to cushion the blow of you on me. You know, I just can't walk around with naked blood and interact and communicate. I don't get it. You know, so for 23 or 4 years, I had something in my system all the time. All the time. You know, I didn't drink every single day, but it was something in me to cushion the impact of just life. You know, I can't do it. I don't know how to do it. The other thing you got to do to get normal is you got to find a woman, because I can't ever be alone. It is a group effort getting me through life. It takes a village. And there's volunteers out there that'll take us on. You know? That's why they have that other program. Can you imagine the consciousness of an individual that would actually live with us on purpose? What are they thinking, you know? Well, this will be fun. You know? But I met her. I met this girl, and we set up housekeeping, and after a while we got married. My dad gave me a job at his machine shop, and he let me sleep in his garage. And I, you know, I had a job, and I tried, and I cleaned it up a little bit. I cleaned it up. You know, I was able to kind of just stumble along and not go to jail. And you know, it got a little bit better. And I met her, and we fell in love, and tried to have a life together. And the time came, we had a couple of kids. And at 37 years old, I'm living in the house with this woman and these two small children, and I had no emotional connection to another living human being. And I didn't know that. I didn't know it was that bad. I can't stand outside myself and have a separate experience and compare it to the one that I'm having to determine that there's anything wrong. I don't know that there's anything wrong. I mean, the alcoholic life seems like the only normal one to me because it's the only one I've ever known. It wasn't like I had another life and then I lost it. Sometimes, for some people, that's true. You know, they started later in life and they had a life and then they lost everything. I never had one. So I don't know that I'm not connected to you. It feels like I'm connected to you because you're such a pain in the ass. You know? Well, you're making demands on me. You want me to take you and the kids to the zoo and stuff, you know? And it's like, I can't do any of this. I can have children, but I don't know what to do with them. You know, once they're around and they start talking to you and stuff, they're more self-centered than me. It's competition. You know? And so I'm not a father. You know, I'm not a husband. There's no sex in the relationship anymore. Sex is a celebration of the intimacy that exists in a relationship. There's no intimacy in any relationships I have, so there's no sex. There's nothing going on. I'm just dead inside, completely dead. Silkworth says a powerful thing in the doctor's opinion. He says, we lose touch with all things human. This was written by a man, not an alcoholic, just observing us, just watching us move through life. It's obvious to other people we are not connected to what's going on around us, including the people that we're with. We are not connected to them. And we don't know that. We don't know that. It's not a conscious thing on my part. But here I am at 37, one more drunk, nothing special. Come home late at night, still sitting there in the morning, sitting in my alcoholic chair. And the sun comes up one more time and I'm in the wrong place. And it's going to be a horrible day. It's going to be an awful day. I'm not going to make it to work. You know, my little daughter gets up and is happy to see that daddy's up early, and I can't even talk to her. I'm so hammered. And every time I look her in the eyes, it just makes me cry. Because the kids can kind of cut through the fog. They can get through it. They'll hurt you. And they don't even know it. They're just happy to be around you. So like any good gangster, I called my mom. My mother had been in Al-Anon for 30 years at this time. My dad got sober when I was 6 years old, so on top of all my other problems, I was raised in an AA house. There's nothing worse than living in a house with two people with clear eyes that know exactly what's going on in your head. Not good. Not good. Al-Anons are efficient and prepared. And she got there quickly, within a half an hour, because you know what happens. If we lay down and take a nap for a half an hour, everything changes. You wouldn't want to rush into anything. You know? And she came and got me, and she took me to Costa Mesa and checked me into a place called Starting Point. And I was in there for 35 days. I went to my first shrink when I was 13 years old because I had rage. Not anger, rage. Double over, fall on the floor in a ball, bile come up from the stomach into the throat, veins throbbing, fist into walls, head into the walls, rage at the injustice of it all. I have no idea where that came from, but I had it when I was really young. I spent a year and a half with that guy, and he helped me, and he introduced me to my favorite subject, me. That lifelong pursuit of self. You know, whenever I hear anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous say, "I'm looking for my truth," I just move away from them because it creeps me out. You know, it's like, the last thing I want to do is find any more out about me. You know, I'm just creeped out with me. You know, it's just weird. I mean, I'm 65 years old, I'm 27 years sober. At this point in my life, I am absolutely, and I mean this sincerely, I am bored to tears with myself. But you, on the other hand, are a never-ending font of weirdness. You know, it just never stops, you know. It's just, you know, but this isn't a self-help program. You're not going to find yourself in AA. It's about being relieved of the bondage of that self that you are looking for. You know, you don't have far to look. It's right in here. It's telling you about itself all the time, constantly. Constantly. Self-talk is insanity. That's insanity. But I was into it. I went to a mental institution twice, and this is a barbed wire on the top of the fence lockdown mental institution. It's where Ken Kesey worked when he wrote Cuckoo's Nest. The ward that I was on is where they filmed that movie. The reason I tell you that is not to brag, but some people went to college. That's all I got. This is it, man, you know. This is, that's my graduate school. You know, AA is my graduate school. I spent 2.5 years in group therapy at one time. I've been to several other shrinks and therapists over the years. I've been gestalted and rolled in primal screens. I know more about myself than is safe to know. So while I was in this recovery program for 35 days, they made me wear a sign around my neck. I had to make the sign. We made it in crafts. A little rectangular piece of cardboard with a string that went through it, and it said, "I am not a counselor." Because evidently there was some confusion about that. Then after 35 days, they let me out. They just let us out, don't they? Like we're okay. Go forth, multiply. And where do we end up? like Tyler said, here, Alcoholics Anonymous, the world's aftercare program, and it's linoleum floors and metal folding chairs for the rest of our natural lives. You know, there's no referrals from AA, did you know that? There's no place you go where you walk in and you say to them, I'm from AA, they sent me here. That place doesn't exist. You know, we are the counselors. The inmates are running the asylum. Stop and think about this. I've been married 3 times and people ask me for relationship advice. I give it to them. I figure, hell, you can't hurt them. They're in AA, you know? Plus the fact, whatever advice I give them could not possibly be worse than what they're planning on doing anyway. So now I'm in AA. I'm a newcomer in Alcoholics Anonymous. What now? What happens? I mean, you hear a lot of stuff, don't you? You hear a lot of stuff. I think there's a lot of really good stuff that's been brought to AA over the years from outside. I think we understand alcoholism a hell of a lot better than we did before. We've got a lot of history with it now. We've got 77 years of working with people. We've got a pretty good idea of what the problem is and what the solution is. I think there's a lot of stuff that's come into AA that's really dangerous. Like, one of the worst things that you can ever tell anybody is take what you can use and leave the rest. Just stop and think about that. Mull it over in your head. Isn't that the way you and I have lived our lives, all of our lives? You're going to leave it up to me with this finely tuned instrument to determine what's good for me? In past history, when have I ever made a really good choice about that? I mean, you're going to ask me to do stuff that's going to make me uncomfortable, and I'm going to go, no. No thanks. I'll just sit right here, thank you. I'm not. Why would I ever consciously put myself in the position to be uncomfortable? I've never done that before. My whole life has been centered around making sure that I'm comfortable. I created a chemical environment around myself to make sure I was comfortable. Why would I consciously be uncomfortable? The most spiritual thing that you'll ever hear in Alcoholics Anonymous is, get in the car. I mean that sincerely. Get in the car. Where are we going? What do you care? Get in the car. You probably wouldn't be surprised at how many people cannot get in the car. They just won't get in the car. They're going to run it themselves, like I always have. My sponsor said a couple of things to me early on. He said, my job as your sponsor is to guide you through the process of the 12 steps, that you might find a power greater than yourself that will solve your problems. I would be happy to sit here and listen to what you think your problems are, so that you will not share about them in the meetings. The meetings are for recovery from alcoholism, not about how your day went. And I informed him, I said, you know, down there at the Alano Club, they're breaking that rule right and left. Should we go tell them? He said, no, he says, AA is a safe place. You can go there and do pretty much whatever you want, share about whatever you want. Nobody can stop you. There's no rules. It's a safe place. That's what you want to do. I'm describing to you my AA. Thank God I found somebody to work with me that didn't buy into this crap that we don't give advice or express opinions. If we didn't do those two things, we wouldn't have anything to say to each other. And I'm a newcomer in AA. I need some good advice. I do not need people quoting page numbers at me. It means nothing to me. I won't read it anyway. And if I did, I probably wouldn't get it. I need a man to sit down across the table from me and tell me what I need to do very clearly. And I was lucky. I found a guy. example. I'm 2-3 months sober. My wife comes home and she says, I'd like you to stay home on Tuesday night and watch the children so that I can go to an Al-Anon meeting. And it pissed me off. I just looked at her and I said, at the top of my lungs, I said, I don't babysit. I couldn't believe she even asked me that. And I stormed out of the house. That's who got here. That's the guy. I made the mistake of telling my sponsor. And he rarely yelled at me. He's not a yeller. You know, he's not a finger pointer, not a finger in the chest guy. You know, I don't know too many of those people. I suppose they're actually around, but I think it's more the way we take it than the way that it's delivered, really. And he informed me. He said, it's not babysitting. They're your children. This was news to me. This was another way to look at the situation. I had never considered that, you know. He says, now you go back there with a smile on your face. You tell your wife you'd be happy to watch the children on Tuesday night while she tries to find recovery in the Al-Anon family groups. So I went back home and I went, thank you, happy. Well, the first Tuesday night rolls around and my little boy is like a year old. I don't know what I thought he was going to do, but he just passed out, you know. And the little girl was 3, you know, we watched TV and we talked and we did some stuff, you know, and then the next week she didn't want to watch TV. We played some board games and things, and then, you know, one night I remember we were sitting outside just playing catch with each other. It was summertime, it was still light out. And as time went on, I developed a relationship with this little girl who is now 30 years old, teaching 5th grade in elementary school, and she just gave me my first grandchild. And she still sits on her daddy's lap. I love her so passionately sometimes it scares me. And I started to have a relationship with her. My wife came home one night. She says, hey, I'm not going to my Al-Anon meeting. I said, well, you better go somewhere. This is my night with the kids. Isn't that how it works? I don't know what page number that's on. That's like a real world problem. That's bad behavior that needs to stop right now, whether I like it or not, irrespective of how I feel about it or what I think about it. It doesn't matter. There is good behavior and there's bad behavior, and I had a lot of bad behavior. And I had men that would sit down and tell me, don't be like that. Don't talk to people like that. You know, don't stand so close when you yell. Don't stick your finger out. You're 6'5" and weigh damn near 300 pounds. You know, sit down and smile when you're speaking to people. You're scary. You know, I actually told me that. It really is scaring the shit out of me right now. Smile. You know, it's not that bad anymore, Bill. You know, the war is over, dude. You know. Here's what I think is going on, for whatever it's worth. The first step, and I did this, I went to his house every week, and we read a chapter in the book each week, and we went through the steps, and he guided me through this process. It's the exact same thing I do with guys now, and I do some step studies and workshops, lots of other stuff. But the down-home thing is me and this guy reading the book and sharing our lives together. You know, he would share his stuff with me. He would listen to me. I mean, the reason you hear people go into meetings and sharing about how their day went is because they don't have a sponsor or they don't have a relationship with one. Part of my job with you is if I'm sponsoring you, if I'm with you, or even if you just feel close to me, is to sit and listen to you tell me about what's going on in your life. I am interested. I'm interested. And if there's any way I can help, I would be happy to help. If I can help you find a job, if I can loan you a few bucks, I've got some money, you need a few bucks, I give you 20 every now and then. Why wouldn't I? You hear these people say we're not a taxi service, we're not a lending institution. Bullshit. I don't read that in the book anywhere. We do all that stuff for each other all the time. If you don't have any money, don't lend money. As a matter of fact, in AA, don't ever lend money. Just give it to them. Because you don't want to be some guy's debtor, man. You know, I don't want to muddy the waters and spoil the relationship, but I'll do what I can to help you. And that's the way this man was with me. And when you hear people come into meetings dumping stuff all the time, constantly in the meetings, they don't have that kind of relationship. And they're clearly not working the steps. If they were, they would be sharing about that in the meeting. You would share that because that is an attribute of the component of their life. It's just my opinion, but it's a really good one. The first step says we're powerless. Now, they took it easy on us, and they just said that we were powerless over alcohol because they did not want us to run screaming down the street. After 27 years of relatively deep research, I've yet to find anything I have any power over at all. I think in nature, I am just utterly and completely and totally powerless. I don't think the totality of all things requires any input from me whatsoever for the unfolding to occur. I think I'm completely powerless. I don't see anything else, any other creature in nature that has any power. They simply seem to do what they do. I mean, the lion eats the lamb every time. And we look at that and we say, that mean old big ugly lion should not eat the lamb. It's unfair. The cute little lamb, you know. And yet, the lion continues to eat the lamb. And we think it's wrong and we suffer over that. So we make up parables and we say, there will come a time in the future when things are good because they're really bad right now. Where the lion will lay down with the lamb, and that behavior will stop. If that day comes, I bet you that lamb will be nervous for eternity. It is the nature of the lion to eat the lamb, and there is no morality play in it. There's no good or bad. It's just the nature of each creature, fulfilling its nature. And we look at those things and we judge them, don't we? We look at things that happen to us or to other people, and we make judgments upon it. We say, that's good and that's bad. That doesn't exist in nature. We create that. Things simply are. They are neither good nor bad. They simply are. And you and I, most all human beings, have a deep and profound trouble with that. We struggle with it. And when we have loss in our life, we feel the pain of the loss. Then we determine that it should not have occurred or that it was unfair. So now we have the pain of the loss and we've laid a layer of suffering over the top of that that will last much longer than the pain of the loss. We will carry that suffering through us to the end of our lives, long after the pain of the loss is gone. Powerless, utterly powerless. The second half says that my life became unmanageable. It alludes to the fact that at one time maybe it was manageable. I don't remember that time. I think my life doesn't need to be managed. I think it just unfolds all the time. The next indicated thing is obvious. The alarm goes off, get up. The bill comes in the mail and says, pay this amount. Pay that amount. You know, I think it's that simple. If I can grasp this just a little bit, this powerlessness, just the drinking thing, just that part, just enough of it, it makes the second step operational. I need to align myself with the power. There is something that seems to be running the show. Maybe I should attempt to tap into that. And I need to be restored to sanity, enough sanity to not drink and use, certainly, but also enough sanity to be able to begin to see the powerlessness, to recognize it. This is the beginning of acceptance. The very beginning of learning to accept things as they are, which includes the people in our lives. Because evidently my happiness is dependent upon your behavior because I spent an inordinate amount of time trying to adjust you so that we can both be a little bit happier. And you would absolutely insist upon living your own life, and it pisses me off at my core, you know, as it's why you can't see the light. If I can do that second step just a little bit, just acknowledge the fact that I need to align myself with the power, the third step becomes operational. Now, the third step is interesting, because they're leading us to believe that we actually have some say in the matter. We're going to turn our life and will over to what already has it anyway. Isn't that the classic alcoholic position? There's the universe and me. That's impossible. That's impossible. But I can just see myself, well, I've withheld myself from the totality of all things long enough now. I'm going to acquiesce and allow you to take me. Thank you very much. You know? Let's give Billy an award. But what life and will is it talking about? The fourth step, the inventory. The resentments, the fears, and broken relationships. The end result of living a life with seeming power. That's the fourth step. What it talks about in the third step, I'm going to turn my life and will over. Here it is. This is the stuff I need to get rid of. The fifth step is the ceremony that we go through to complete the third step. We physically and literally give it to someone else. We say it to ourselves, to this other person sitting with us, and to this manager. Here's my stuff. I'm pooped. You take it. Six and seven are two paragraphs in the book, Character Defects. You say the prayer, it's over. There's nothing to do. And we'll be doing that nothing for the rest of our lives. And you can see what the character defects are. They're in the fourth column of the resentment list. It doesn't say what was my part. It says what were my faults and mistakes. Even if I was molested as a child or beaten as a child, if I'm 40 years old and I'm still carrying that resentment around, at the bare minimum, I'm unforgiving. And it's not about the perpetrator. It's not about agreeing with what occurred. It's about relieving myself of that wound, of that scar. I played no part in that. But I have to let it go. If there's going to be freedom or peace in my life, I must at some point let it go. And that's an art much more than it is a science. The manager gives us our first assignment. He says, make amends. I'm going to help rid you of the resentments. The mechanism for ridding ourselves of those resentments is the eighth and ninth step. We go back to those people and we take responsibility for our faults and mistakes, whatever it might be. Now, at the end of the ninth step, have I grown up? Am I capable of intimacy now? Can I truly connect with you? No. 1 through 9 is about 15% of the program, maybe only 10. It's the bare minimum. It's sober 101. It's the least amount we have to do in order to develop a message that has some depth and weight. In order to clear the decks for the real work that's going to begin to start now. And we suffer over 1 through 9, don't we? We have year-long workshops and 15-column expanded versions of the inventory, and there's people out there doing inventory after inventory after inventory. It's just another form of self-obsession. Have I done many inventories? Yeah, I have. You know, because I sponsor people. I'm always in the book, you know? I'm always doing workshops. I'm always part of stuff, so I'm always writing stuff down. I'm looking at myself a lot, more than I'd like to, really. But that's not the purpose of it, to me. 10, 11, and 12, people say, are the maintenance steps. Maintain what? What have I got at the end of the ninth step that needs maintenance? No. Is this just about not drinking? I don't think so. I think it's about a lot more than that. I think Alcoholics Anonymous is the single most significant social movement of the 20th century. David Hawkins, in his book Power vs. Force, talks about it. It has touched the lives of 50% of the population of North America alone. Just North America. That's close to 300 million people. That is the most significant social movement of the 20th century. It doesn't even include the rest of the world. You know, they do a census every 4 or 5 years out of GSO to see how many people there are in AA. They figure there's like 2.5 million. If you get into those statistics, which I have, if you look into how they develop those numbers, you come to understand they have no idea at all how many people are in AA. They're not even close. They say there's 150,000 meetings in AA. There could be 400,000 or 500,000 meetings. There certainly is more than 2.5 million people, maybe 4 or 5 million, maybe more. They have no idea. How many meetings do you go to that aren't registered with New York? Any meeting that's not registered doesn't get counted, and the people in it don't get counted. They take a sampling. There's people you'll hear around AA walking around how we've lost our edge, that we used to have a 75% success rate, now it's less than 5%. I'm here to report to you. I travel around AA a lot. An Alcoholics Anonymous is alive and well and as vibrant and as effective as it has ever been. It's better than it's ever been. It's better, I think. The children are coming now. Have you noticed? Have you seen them? Do you get them out here? The 15-year-olds and the 16-year-olds, do you? Move your heads up and down, yes or no? Okay, I just want to make sure you're awake. You know, the kids are coming. My home group is the Hermosa Beach Men's Day. There's about 100 guys in there. It's where the men are men and the sheep are nervous. You know, we're a badass right-wing AA group. We don't want to hear about how your day went. If you start sharing about your girlfriend, we'll just clap till you stop. You know, we're one of those guys. You know, half the room is gay, but we don't talk about that. You know, it's like... And a few years ago, the kids started showing up. They were always out in the parking lot, but they started coming into the meeting. And a few years ago, this kid, this 15-year-old kid, has taken a one-year birthday cake, and he's standing up at the head of the room, and it can be intimidating because we are judging you. We're not shy. We'll give you a written report afterwards of how you did. So this kid's standing up at the head of the room, and he's taking his cake. And at the end of his talk, he gave the most right-wing talk I've ever heard. At the end of it, he was standing there pointing and yelling. And he says, if you're sitting out there and you don't have a sponsor and you're not working the steps, may God have mercy on your soul. I went up and asked him to be my sponsor. And for weeks after that, we're walking around looking at each other going, may God have mercy on your soul. Recovery is available at all levels of our society now. It's available. It's part of the lexicon. It's part of the language. They make TV shows about it. I don't watch any of them because I live it. It's enough, you know. You don't need to dramatize it. It's already dramatic and traumatic, you know. So how they can say that we've lost our edge, I don't get it. You know, and I don't agree with it. And it's not been my experience. 10, 11, and 12, it's 85% of the program. It's where we live. It's where we live our lives. 10 is the continuing inventory process. It's about self-awareness as compared to self-obsession. If what happened to me when in March of 85 is I was awakened, the rest of the journey is to take that awakening and turn it into some kind of an awareness where I'm actually aware that I'm awake and maybe there's something I can do with this. Maybe there's a reason why I'm here. Maybe this isn't just for me to find myself. It's not a support group or a self-help group. Maybe it's not just about socializing, all of which occurs here. But maybe there's a reason I'm supposed to be here. Maybe there's a purpose behind this. I don't even need to know what it is. All I got to do is open my eyes and pay attention. And there's two things I live my life by. I try vigorously to live my life by these two things. One is get rid of caller ID. Answer the phone. Stop controlling the experience. Have faith that whoever is calling me is supposed to be in my life. That it's not a mistake. That they're supposed to be there. I'm powerless. Let it happen. Let it happen. And this is how it happens. That's how they get a hold of us now. The second thing is you never say no. Why would you say no? Let it happen. Get in the car. Have faith that wherever you're being asked to go or to do or to say is what's supposed to happen. It's how he gets a hold of us. And I say to myself, I don't want to go to Visalia. Go anyway. Who knows why I'm supposed to be here? I don't know. I don't care anymore. I love the energy of AA. I love being around it. I know now that when I get in the airplane or I get in the car, when I get there, I'm going to feel the power. And I feel it all the time. You know, I've become used to it, really. I'm on a liver transplant list. I spend a lot of time in the hospital, in and out. When I come here, you heal me. And I mean that. I can walk in here dragging ass and brain dead and meaning as hell. And by the end of the hour and a half, I just simply feel better. Just by being around the energy of people who are alive that should be dead. And I believe that. I can watch myself move through life. That's the 10th step. paying attention, being mindful. The 11th step, in meditation, which is not extra credit. It's in the step. In meditation, I can have the very real experience of watching my thoughts. I can sit and take a few deep breaths and focus on my breathing. And when my mind wanders away, which it always does, that's what minds do, I can catch it and bring it back to the breath. The question is, who's doing the catching? I'm not sure I have the answer for that, but I can tell you one thing by this experience, and anyone sitting in this room can have this experience. You come to understand at depth, you are not your thinking mind. That is a game-changing thing. When you really grasp that at depth. In AA, we say things like, my head's out to get me. We talk about it in the third person. I think we figured it out. Of course, we make it adversarial. I don't think it's out to get me. I think it's trying to help. It's just stupid. I mean, stop and think about it. Why would it kill the host? All it's capable of doing is taking the past and projecting it into the future. That's all it does. It creates nothing. It just takes credit for shit. You know? It just takes the past. It's flat and two-dimensional. It's not creative. It never comes up with new stuff. Now that I can see that, now that I know that, because I've had the experience of it, not just the intellectual understanding, but the experience, and knowing this that transcends the intellect, experiencing the higher power, not thinking about it, no belief mechanism tied to it, experiencing it. That's what happens in AA, is we experience the movement of the force all the time, especially if we're paying attention. It's an experience. It requires no dogma. There doesn't have to be a belief mechanism tied to it at all. You can simply tap into it at will, anytime you want. Now that I know that I'm not my thinking mind, I don't have to analyze it. I don't have to change it. I don't have to work on it. I don't have to share it with others. I can simply ignore the damn thing. And it will die off out of just pure neglect. Because it wants me working on it. It believes it's me. And I believe it's me too. We're in collusion together. And it comes up with stuff and I attach emotion to it and we go about our business out there creating havoc in the world. You know? Once I unplugged from that, this happened to me when I was about 20 years sober. When I stopped reading stuff and doing stuff to gather information to just give back to you, and I started doing it with intent because I really needed help, because I was really sick and I was frightened and I was depressed. And I started meditating with intent, and it changed my life. It literally changed my life. And I didn't do anything that I did not already know about for many years, but knowing it means nothing until you actually apply it and you internalize it and you have the experience of it. Powerful stuff. Powerful stuff. Great tool. Very simple. 2 to 3 minutes at a shot. That's all. The only way you can do it wrong is to not do it. The 12th step is why we're here. Should everybody sponsor? Absolutely. There's nothing else to do. There is no other job in Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything else is an activity. And the activities are all fun. I've done them all. But don't ever mistake the activity for the action. Whatever prejudice that you might have will walk across the room and ask you for help. Now you have a choice. You have a choice. If you want to hang on to the prejudice, if you want to maintain your opinion and your position, send it away. And you can find a lot of support for that in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a lot of people that will support you in sending people away that are incorrectly alcoholic. Lots of people in AA won't work with people on medication. I've had no experience with that. Lots of people in AA won't work with people that are drug addicted. I don't have any, I don't identify. No. I was never raised that way. You never say no. You have no idea why they're asking you for help. You have no idea why they've been sent to you. Maybe they need to hang on to you for a while until they find the right person to be with. That's happened to me a lot over the years. I don't think they have a problem being a drug addict. I think what they're looking for is recovery. Do you know anything about that? I know a lot about recovery. I'll work with anybody. I don't care what your problem is. And when I'm sponsoring you, I will tell you where you need to go. And I have connections in other fellowships. Of course I do. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a member of the recovery community. The recovery houses are not our enemies. They're our friends. They don't always handle themselves well. They dump people on us that maybe they shouldn't, but they are not the enemy. They are our friends. They're helping us in this work. That's how people get to us now, is through recovery houses, not off the street anymore, rarely. It's up to us to deal with whatever comes. We don't get to pick and choose. This is a spiritual program, not an intellectual one. It's just happening all the time. It's just flowing all the time. People's lives are saved here every day. And the vehicle that's used for that life-saving is us. It's us. This guy walked up to me and asked me to sponsor him. He says, I think I should tell you that I'm gay. I said, wouldn't you rather have a gay sponsor? He looked right at me and he says, no, I don't have a problem being gay, but drinking is an issue. Who knew? Guy walked up to me. I used to stand up here at these podiums and I would say, if you were on medication, that you weren't sober. Now, I didn't know anything about that, but I don't require knowledge to form an opinion. All I need to do is hear some of you say that stuff, and I want to feel like part of you, and I want to be a right-wing badass, so I just start repeating what you say to me. Without not knowing that you're full of shit. You know, I don't know, that sounds really good to me. You know, so I just pick it up. So sure enough, this guy walks across the room and he says, I'm bipolar and I'm on medication. Will you sponsor me? Jeez. But you can't say no. You can't say no. It's a rule. You can't say no. If I want my life to stay small, I'll control the experience. If I want it to get larger, I'll just let her rip and just go with whatever comes along. So I start reading the book with this guy, and I had the experience of peeling him off the ceiling and lifting him off the floor. The 40-year-old grown man, the guy curled up in my lap one time, put his head in my shoulder, and cried like a baby. And I'm sitting there rocking him. My wife, Karen, walked through the room. She goes, whoa. I mean, that will get your attention, you know? Now when I see that guy coming, I go, have you taken your medication? So I had an opinion, then I had an experience, and it changed my opinion. That's how it works. If I don't have the experience, nothing will change. Nothing will change. If all I'm doing is going to meetings, nothing will change. If I'm not sponsoring people, nothing will change. I will never confront my defects of character. If I don't sponsor people, it'll never happen. That's the mechanism that is used to cause us to address 6 and 7. I'll sit and give a guy a 20-minute talk on how he should live his life. He'll leave the room and I'll think to myself, man, that's good stuff. I should try some of that. I'll tell you to pray and meditate every morning, and I won't do it myself, but I'll tell you to do it. And I'll lead you to believe by telling you that that's what I do. Is that a lie? But of course it is. You know, the road gets narrower. I'm a liar. You know? Being 10 years sober, I'm actively trying to make a name for myself in an anonymous organization. I was president of AA at the time. You know? And I had some sort of mental and emotional collapse. And I went to my sponsor and he said, go find God. And I yelled at him and I said, don't treat me like a newcomer. I don't need any mindless platitudes. And he yelled at me again and he said, you talk a good game, now go do it. I said, I think I should quit talking at meetings. He goes, you don't get to pick and choose, but why don't you start telling the truth? And I went, I'm not lying. He goes, stop doing theater. Tell us what's really going on with you. We'll get it. Everything changed. Everything changed. If I hadn't been sponsoring people, if I hadn't been doing that work, none of that would have been confronted. I would have never run into myself. You cannot replace that with anything else, with any other activity. There's nothing as powerful as sitting across the table from a guy. When two people come together, not just one is healthy. I was under the illusion that I'm the one that it's all springing forth from me. No. That isn't what's going on at all, you know? It's my medicine. It's what's causing me to grow up to become a man. You know, I met a woman in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we've been together 18 years, and I never thought I could be so close to somebody in my life. I never knew. I didn't know. I've never experienced it. I didn't know what love was. I'm not capable of it. I'm not capable of receiving it or giving it. Today, that's different now. I've grown up. I'm not a frightened little boy anymore. You know, I've grown up. I'll close with this. People will tell you in AA, you got to give it away to keep it. No. You have to give it away to even get it. If you're not giving it away, you don't have it. Thank you very much.